Okay, thank you all for coming, and welcome to the Interns Lightning Talks. So this year again, we have a lot of Google Summer of Code interns, and I am very happy that some of them are here to tell us about their projects. So every one of those interns will now have... All right, Google Summer of Code and Outreachy, sorry. I sometimes forget this because I'm only... involved with all the GSOC stuff, usually. So every one of those interns will have 4 minutes time to present his project. The slides are already here. We have a wireless mouse for you, so you can walk around if you want. Just use the left mouse click to go forward and the right one to go backward, if you want to go backward. Very simple. You can also just use arrow keys. And after your lightning talk, I have brought to you chocolate from Hamburg. So you get out of here properly fed, right? Before the next lightning talk happens, I will tell the name of the person after the next lightning talk. So the next person, please just stay at this side of the stage, and then you can come up quickly so we can go through this very quickly. Okay? Then let's start. So the first talker is Atul Anand. Oh, right, I'm sorry. So I have one very important task for the audience. So when I raise one arm, I want you to do this. Can we all do this right now? Right, just this. Clapping with one finger, each hand. So it is a quiet noise to remind the speaker of his time running off, right? And when I raise both my hands, then we just clap. So the speaker has no choice but to end his presentation, okay? So. Okay, great. We can do this. So. The first speaker is Atul Anand, and the speaker after is Alexandru Pandelea.
Okay. Hello, everybody. My name is Atul Anand, and I am working on a project that says proxies in Network Manager. So, and my mentor is David Udhaus, sir. He's not here, I guess. So, yeah, he's here. So. So that's the first page that tells what actually is a proxy. Proxies are generally, so that I just wanted to speak. Proxies are generally as simply like a server that talks on behalf of clients to the main server that we are requesting to get the resources. So that we already have a feature when we open a Firefox, we see a picture like this, and that's for configuring proxies. How many people are using this. So that's basically a simple page for configuring the proxies. But what happens when we try to configure proxies for multiple connections? So like when we are connected to wireless and we are connected to some other VPN. So all the proxy stuffs, how Firefox will decide to what proxies to choose and which proxy servers to choose. So that's what I did. I just implemented a generic page for each of the connections. So there's a page for VPN, there's a page for wireless. So you can configure just each page for each of the connections, and that's fine, and that is going to work. So they are not going to mingle to each other, so everything is going to work smoothly. So that's the tab in NM Connection Editor. It's the GUI that we see in Fedora. And Genome, that's it. And it will be available in NM 1.4 that is going to release at the end of this month. So, and this is what I have actually implemented this. This is actually, the project is basically designed by fixing two packages. It's, one is Network Manager, the basic Network Manager that is default Network Manager in Fedora and every Linux platforms that is. And one other is PaceRunner. It is a project that is from the Conman team. Yeah, and it is for For actually, it does the actual parsing of JavaScript files, and that's it. So we are just sending our every details that a network manager is collecting from the internet, and it is just pushing to the pace runner. So pace runner is the basic interface that applications is going to ask this, and pace runner will reply. So network manager just configures pace runner, and pace runner will reply to questions, proxy questions to everybody that is going to every application that is going to ask. Thank you. That's the project.
Okay, the next person is Amisha Singla. Okay, and no, after you. So the next person, right? If you know the software verification notation. So now we have Alexandre Pandelia, correct? With Nautilus and battery naming.
Yeah. Hey everyone, my name is Alex, and this summer I've been working on implementing a battery name for Nautilus under the mentorship of Carlos Soriano. Let's first start with a question. Why was this necessary? So let's imagine the following situation. We arrive from vacation and we upload our photos from our camera to our computer, and the photos have a completely irrelevant name from which we understand nothing and we'd like to change that. Until now, we could do that by downloading some auxiliary battery naming software, though most people don't do that because it takes a lot of time to download and learn how to use that. But now you can do that much easily directly from Nautilus. So this is how the dialogue looks like after launching a batch naming operation. So the original file name is a tag, and there are also other tags which I'll explain later. So now you can add text before the tag, so you will append something before the name or right after. So to make you understand better, I'm going to give you an example. So here we have numbering, followed by a certain name we want to give, and some metadata, though this is only available if every file has it. Now, this is some menus. The first one in the left is for sorting. If the user doesn't like the initial order of the files, he can change it. And the other menu is representing the tags that the user can add. So the numbering and the original file names are always available. And there is also the metadata that each file has it. Okay, so this is the other mode, the replace mode. So here you can you add the text that you want to replace and the replacement, and then the replaced part will be highlighted so that you can see easier what will happen. Okay, so another part is handling conflicts. For instance, when a new name would conflict with an existing file, those rows would get highlighted. And also a label with two buttons would pop up so that you can use the buttons to navigate through all the conflicts so that you can change the name to a better one. So that was all. Thanks for listening.
Don't forget your chocolate, but if you forgot it, you can take it afterwards. People always forget it. So now we have Amisha Singla with adding print route support for GNOME Maps.
Hello, myself Amisha. So I'm currently working as a software developer in a company called Mapbox. Yeah, so it's again related to the maps. So as a part of my outreachy project, I interned with GNOME Maps and being mentored by Jonas Danielson and Damien Oils. Though they are not here right now, I'm missing them, but other maps people are here and also the other, I mean, like GNOME people. And so, yeah. So let's talk about why. Like, why are we adding print support for GNOME Maps? Like, say, you're not having any working internet or you're not having any smartphones, like then what will you do? So now it comes into the picture, like can we have something like all the instructions somewhere printed so that we can like whenever we're going for a travel, so we can just like follow that particular route. So that's how like the idea came up, and like we integrated this feature in GNOME Maps. So yeah, so this is how it looks. Like you just can add, like you can click on the print route button and it will give you something like, so you can print it a file and this is how the output looks like. So you have this complete map view and this shows you the complete like from point to and from point via points and two points and also the instructions like, over it, and then like you have these mini maps. So basically what mini maps is like, it consists of the route, like the part of the route, like only the places like where you start from and where you end to and from some and for the via points. Like basically this idea was proposed so that like whenever user starts from any particular, you say city, so the area, I mean the routes are a bit, you know, complex over there when you're just like heading to some highway, so it's not required, like all this mini maps are not required there. So yeah, so that's how we thought of it, and like we had just instructions for like all the path and just mini maps from 4 points, 5 points and 2 points. And now this is another design for like the small routes, like where we don't need any mini maps because we are able to see the complete route in the map view itself. So what did I use for getting it done? So these are some libraries for which like I made use, like GTK Print API. Then there is Cairo and Pango Cairo. So frankly speaking, like I was really not aware of these libraries when I started with like submitted my application, but like later somehow in the program itself, I learned all these libraries and get it done. So like this is like a major learning experience while, you know, doing the project. So I also learned like writing good code because I know like how badly I used to code, like without commenting, without indentation and all this stuff. Like GNOME actually made me, you know, learn all this stuff, and also approaching people for help, like how to be patient on IRC and, you know, asking people for help, helping other people to get involved in the community, because I myself know that like what are the troubles which I face like while getting into the community. So yeah, and also a little of reviewing and, you know, sharing this with all of you in this conference. So yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Thanks. Now we have Carla Quintana Carrasco. And afterwards, we have Gabriel Ivascu. And this is about visual and graphic design.
Yeah. Hi, all. I'm dying here, so please be gentle. So my work here on GNOMES is to improve the visual design. And I do it through corporate identity. And I don't mean, with corporate, I don't mean enterprise, I mean a brand, to improve the brand. So this is a quote of one of my favorite designers, which explains what corporate identity is. So basically it says that they are the elements who enforce a brand and people recognize it. So the three areas that I'm actioning is the color, the graphic elements, and typography. So first, I did an analysis with all the white color palette that is being used, and is a lot of confusing. So I, with the help of my mentor, I did a smaller palette with one main color, the blue one, and four supplementary color. And typography, same as the color, it was a huge use of type fonts. So we basically tied up to one, the Source Sans Pro, to the lightest version. And the graphic elements, they are also very, very variated. So I choose this triangle pattern to establish the design, the design's elements, to make it more simpler to reproduce. So this is the examples of the all these three main designs that I did. And that's the business card, the letters, basic stationery, greeting cards. And the main goal in this project is to do a manual with a guideline style to strengthen the brand. Thank you. I take my chocolate.
Julian Radu. Okay. So next we have Gabriel Ivascu with Web, Bookmarks and Sync.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Gabriel, and this summer I've been working on introducing a bookmark sync feature for Web Epiphany with the help of my mentor Michael, and also with the hope that it can be later extended to also sync passwords, history, and maybe open tabs in the near future. Since every form of sync implies the existence of a server, I had to choose whether to use OwnCloud or Mozilla for this purpose. Together with my mentor, we concluded that Mozilla is a better option because it would allow users to sync data with their servers with only a Firefox account and no configuration required, while OwnCloud would require the users to set up their own server. Throughout the sync process, I had to interact with three of the Mozilla servers: the Firefox account server, the token server, and the storage server. Each of these servers are HTTP based. Most of the requests going to this server have to be HOK authenticated. HOK is a HTTP authentication scheme based on HMAC digests of the requests and responses. It covers the HTTP method, the request URI, the host, and optionally the request payload. Also, the clients have to encrypt their data before uploading to the server. The first server that I had to deal with is the Firefox account server. This supports both authenticated and unauthenticated requests. It validates the sign-in and the sign-up requests and initiates a new session. It also returns the session token that will be further used to obtain a signed browser ID certificate. Moreover, it will return a key fetch token that we will use to retrieve the sync keys that are going to be used to encrypt the data that is going to be sent to the storage server. Here you can see a screenshot of the Firefox iframe loaded in a WebKit web view inside the preference dialog of Epiphany. The users are going to use this form to create a new account or to sign in with an existing account. The second server is the token server. This enforces a browser ID assertion based on the signed browser ID certificate obtained from the Firefox account server. Its solely purpose is to return the storage endpoint together with the storage credentials. What we basically do here is that we create a browser ID assertion that we are going to trade for these credentials. Finally, the third server is the actual storage server. This allows only authenticated access through hawk signed requests using the credential obtained from the token server. It stores the data as JSON objects organized into named collections. It also tracks the elementary metadata, providing a last time modified timestamp that clients are going to use to query the server when they are going to ask for changes. Since it does not support push notifications, this is going to be... what I mean is that the most complexity of the sync is going to fall in the responsive of the client, which is okay. That was it. Thank you.
Thanks. Razvan Hitu? I work on that. So next we have Julian Radu with Web Bookmarks Subsystem Update.
Hello everyone, my name is Julian and my project was Web Bookmarks Subsystem Update and my mentor is Michael. The main idea behind this project was to implement a new bookmark system. But also, preceding that, I also had to port a part of code from GTK Action to G Action. This actually took a lot longer than I expected, but because at the start I tried to do everything at once, and it didn't really work out. But in the end, I took a more action-by-action approach, and it worked out. Okay, for the bookmarks system, it's much simpler than the previous one. I decided to start everything from scratch because the previous one was too complicated and was riddled with bugs. There are basically bookmarks and tags, and a bookmark can have multiple tags, and then you can use to quickly browse through your bookmarks. I saved everything to disk using GVDB, and I do all these changes when the user changes a bookmark or adds a new one or removes one. And also, everything gets saved when the browser syncs data with the Mozilla servers. Okay, these are some screenshots. This is the add bookmark popover. You can access it from the location entry at the top of the browser just by pressing the star. You can set the title and its tags. You can also add more tags. This is the popover. You can find a list of all existing bookmarks. There's also the tags stack inside the popover. Here you can find all the existing tags, and at the end, all the bookmarks that have no tag. Clicking a tag will switch to the tag details tag that displays a list of all tags that have that bookmark. And this is the bookmark properties dialog that you can access by pressing the wheel at the end of the row. Here you can change the title and the tags again, and also the address. And there's also a few more things to do. Add a bookmarks migrator. This should read the old bookmark database file and add the bookmarks to the new system. There's already support for that. I just have to write one more function. I have to update the location entries completion model. So each time you search for something, you can also get suggestions from the existing bookmarks. And I have to, because I also have to implement the new location entry design, because currently to access the location entry and the star, so you can bookmark the page, you first have to click on the title head bar. Yes, that's all.
Thank you. Now we have Razvan Kitu. No, it was almost good. Okay, well, and afterwards we have Rares Visalom. Okay, with compressed files in Nautilus.
Hello everyone, I'm Razvan actually, and I have been working on adding support to compressed files in Nautilus under the mentorship of Carlos Soriano and Cosimo Cecchi. So, archives are basically folders, so naturally users would expect to be able to work with them right from their file manager. Now, on top of this, why would anyone want to actually work with them in a compressed format? Archive managers hide a lot from the user. For example, file roller will usually decompress stuff on a hidden location on your system and will probably never delete it. You can check that. The first feature I implemented as part of my project was extraction. We are going to offer the same two options that are available now in FileRoller. Extract here will just output the files to the current directory, and extract to will ask the user to select a location at first. What we did different with extraction is that we will always make sure that only one item gets created. The item created will always have the same name as the source archive. In this way, it will be a really easy task to select it, to find it once the operation is complete. On top of this, we'll have integrated progress feedback so the user can track the operation, and at the end of the operation, the file will be automatically selected, making it an even easier task. With extraction in Nautilus, we move on to the next feature implemented as part of my project. Now, the main idea of the project was to encourage users to work with their files in a regular format. We decided that the best way to achieve this is to make extract here the default option for when opening archives. It takes about the same time to extract a regular archive that it takes to open archive managers like FileRoller, so why not do it from the beginning? This is the advantage that all the content in the archive will be available right from the start to do any operation without any other drawbacks that compressed formats have. Moving on to the next feature, which is compression. This functionality will work in a similar way with an existing operation in Nautilus, which is new folder with selection. Users are expected to just select a few files and then right-click and choose compression. Now, at this point, we run into a little problem because we could not decide on what UI to use for selecting the compression option. Here is a design that we took from FileRoller, but as you can see, it displays a lot of options which are most likely going to never be used. So, I asked Alan Day to help me, and he actually suggested this mockup, which has the advantage of guiding the user with suggestive descriptions, and yeah. But this one had the problem too, as we showed it on IRC, and immediately after, people started arguing that we are not displaying enough options. So what are we supposed to do? Yeah, if anybody has an idea, please make sure you'll tell it to us, because it really appreciate. Yeah. Yeah. So while this project might be over soon, work on compressed files is not yet completed. A lot of users have requested an option to export the contents of an archive without actually decompressing it. And this is already possible through GVFSD archive, a backend. But it has a problem. It lacks write support, and we are not yet sure if we should implement this or not. But anyway, that's all for now, so thank you very much.
Thanks. So, afterwards we have Zeiful, okay. And now we have Rares Visalom with Polari, improve the user experience, correct? Yeah. Great.
Hello, my name is Rares, and I have spent my summer working for Polari. Oh, wait a second. Yeah, right. So I have worked on Polari this summer on improving the user experience. My mentors are Florian Müller and Bastian Ilso, to whom I owe a lot of thanks. I have stressed these guys a lot during this time. So I will first start out with the first feature. Actually, my work involves two main features. The user tracker, which is not visually available to the user, but it works in the backend. And the user popovers that we are going to talk about next. So this is kind of the outcome of the user tracker. As you see, all that it does is enables the user, the client, actually Polari, to display the correct color of user nicks. So if, for example, the bugbot is always online, as you all know, and other users may be offline. The user tracker enables you to kind of know which user is online in which room. This is kind of the hierarchy that works in the user tracker. First, we have the user status monitor that kind of spawns user trackers for each and every account or networks, as you know it. So, for example, we would have a different account for a different user tracker for irc.gnome.org, for Freenode, and for any other account. The reason for this separation will be detailed a few slides next. So, the need for the new user tracker module. Why did we need it? First of all, the first user tracking code that we had did its job very well, but it did not enable us to kind of develop the popovers that we are going to talk about next. There was no actual status. It was just the color of the nicknames, and the actual nick tags that are in the chat view enabled us to track their status. So I will move on to the next feature, which are the user popovers. As you see, whenever you click on a nick, this popover pops out, of course, and you are presented with a spinner that kind of loads until the first data is fetched from the server. You have an option to privately message the user and to view his past activity. Also, his nickname and his status are displayed above. Now, whenever the data loads, you are first presented with the last activity, which usually is pretty recent if the user is online, and his real name, if he has said it prior to this opening of the pop-up. Now I'm going to talk about the statuses that the user tracker tracks. First of all, we have the global status, and then we have the local status. What does global status mean? Well, it means that user is online in a different room other than the current one you are in, but you're still online in that room as well. So you're able to track its status across all the rooms that you're online in. And the local status, of course, is about the status in the current given room. So, first of all, this is how the popover looks when the user is offline. And a cool feature we added is that we added a notification button, which is a toggle button, actually. Whenever you press the button, you kind of enable Polari to give you a notification whenever that user comes online. This is pretty helpful. I mean, if you want to talk to a specific person, but you're not sure when he or she will be online, you kind of press the button and you wait for a notification. Of course, you can press the button again because it's a toggle button, and you won't be prompted with a notification when the user appears online. When you press the button, the popover will show you that you are waiting for that user to come online. Yeah, I know. Thank you for reminding me. And yeah, this was actually my last slide, so this is where my presentation ends. I hope you enjoyed it. And I'm in time.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Seful. I'll be talking about the audio tag editor and no music. My mentors are Felipe Borges, who's here, and Carlos. I'm not sure how he looks. Oh, hey, hello. Thank you for coming. So my project has three parts. I suppose all of you know what a tag editor is supposed to look like. I mean, what a tag editor is in music. It lets you edit the details, metadata of your music files. Okay. So my project has three parts. First is the update backend. That is actually not really Tracker, but I'm sending Sparkle updates to Tracker. So Tracker already does most of in-file indexing and metadata extraction. So it just makes sense that it also should do the write back. So any update queries like delete, insert, where that you send to Tracker will result in an update to a physical file, provided it's the format is supported. Okay. The next is the user interface. The user interface is a instant apply dialog for a single song. It will only support single songs at the moment, but I'm working on it. There are 8 tags that can be edited: title, album, artist, composer, genre, track, disc, and year. Well, let me show you the UI. When you press the edit details button for a selected song in the select mode, this dialog pops up. All the entries can be edited. And meanwhile, in the background, all the data is being downloaded, the automatic metadata, which will be the best data. The first entry that we fetch is just shown below the each of the entries so that you can apply it using that tick. I mean, actually the UI is still, I'm not sure about it. It might change. It will change, actually. This screenshot is a bit, old. Okay, this is the last part, the Grillo side. Thanks to Victor for all the help. So rather than reading this, I'll just walk you through this. There's first the ChromaPrint plugin that uses an algorithm from GStreamer from Live ChromaPrint to convert to get a fingerprint from a music file, which is then passed on to the AccoustID plugin, which uses the string fingerprint and the duration as parameters for a lookup, and uses the web service to fetch the MusicBrainz ID, which is then again used by the MusicBrainz plugin to get all the other metadata. So that about covers my project. This can be much better, like multiple songs and whole album editing. And MusicBrainz is having some sort of trouble with their server. You'll get all sorts of, if you run it from the command line, you'll get all sorts of rate limit reached and service unavailable replies. But I think they're working on it, and they'll do a revamp soon. Tracker has this error, write back error, that only the first update works on that file, and after that only the DB is updated. I think maybe Carlos is working on it. Okay, and there are a few UI and update bugs that are entirely my responsibility, and I hope you'll use it and report any and all bugs that you'll find. Thank you. I'm done.
Okay, thanks. Yes, take your chocolate. So now we have Umang Jane, with uploading photos to Google.
So hi, I'm Umang Jane, and my GSOC project was uploading photos to Google, GNOME photos. My mentor was Debashi Izia, and so disclaimer, there is no text in my slides, only just the screenshots, and I'll walk you through what was the project all about. So after the major feature addition of editing cycle in for the 3.20 cycle of GNOME photos, the major feature was missing was like the user was not able to share his photos to other sources. So basically this was the starting point. And basically, we decided to share photos to the Google Photos of Picasa. Picasa is now deprecated and only we have Google Photos now. So basically, how it works is we have a SharePoint manager, and this dialog what you can see is communicates to the SharePoint managers. And for each we have email and Google. So these both are SharePoints. These are just the derived classes. And how this is being added is from Google online accounts. So if you add a Google online account, you will get a Google. And if you add a Facebook, you will get a Facebook. Like it is very extensible. We will extend this to Bluetooth sharing and Facebook sharing in the future. So basically this talk I will partition into two parts. And one was the sharing, which was my project. And another, what was the problem I faced while implementing this feature. So the interesting part was the solving that problem, right? So in GNOME Photos, when you add an online account, it will fetch if you add a Google account, it will fetch all your photos from the Google and it will show you in the overview mode. So like you get, like it's a manager, photo manager. So while you are uploading a photo to Google, the application doesn't know that it has been uploaded from the same application, right? Same source, like the local photo. So what we faced is, like, then you have the online miners in GNOME Photos will fetch the uploaded image, the recent uploaded image, and will update the UI. So what you finally get is your local image and your remote image, which is exactly the same. So to solve that problem, what we did was, after the upload has been the pic has been uploaded successfully, we would insert a remote object into the tracker's database manually with the same identifier, so that after inserting it, we would relate that. So basically there is a mapping from remote object to the local object, and in the view model we just check if an URN, if an object has a related to property as set, we would just avoid that object to come up into the overview mode, because GNOME Photos also supports additional features like as searching, advanced features. Like when you can get all the images from Google only or Facebook only, like filtering. So if we totally miss out the object, it would not get filtered. So that was the trade-off I have to take in mind. So there is nothing there. This is sharing from the selection mode. And if you are previewing the photo, you can just also share from there. So basically that was it. Thank you. And big thanks to Debashi. Thank you.
Hello. Okay. So, a big thanks to all the interns. You are doing great projects, and we love that you're with us in the community. So I think that's worth a round of applause, isn't it?